You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Joint Council 56 and Boilermakers Local 83. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We're proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to giving working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And this show is sponsored by the proud union Boilermakers Local 83 from Kansas City, Missouri, office and Iowa, Nebraska, and Kansas. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, before last year, pundits had declared the strike to be dead. You couldn't win, they said, and added that unions would soon die too. Wrong. Guess who has revived the strike and is giving us lessons on how to win? It's teachers, of course. Get educated tonight when three local teachers and a reporter from Labor Notes discuss the strikes in West Virginia, Los Angeles, Minnesota, Denver, Oakland, and more. In the news, Missouri Senator Cunningham wants to cut the pay of young workers and tipped workers. And Nellie Don, the musical, doesn't tell the whole story. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. And she's going to talk about James Connolly. Of course, it's St. Pat's Day and the Irish Revolution. Now for the news.
The Missouri Times Southeast Edition reported last week that after some kerfuffle, Tuesday evening, a Senate bill modifying Missouri's minimum wage rate was ultimately stalled. The bill, put forth by State Senator Mike Cunningham, a Republican, seeks to change how the minimum wage would be applied to employees who are under the age of 18. Employers would only be required to pay those employees, dubbed minor employees, just 85% of the set minimum wage. Additionally, Cunningham's law seeks to freeze the amount tipped employees make. It stimulates those employees should receive no less than 50% of the minimum wage rate set as of January 1st, 2019. After that, it would not go up with inflation. His bill is SB 10, and it encountered fierce opposition from Democrats, who called it an anti-worker bill. Antithetical to the will of Missouri voters, the Senate did not vote on the bill. It can be taken up at a later time. The minimum wage hike passed by 62% of Missouri voters last November, but that doesn't faze Senator Cunningham, who thinks he knows best and claims he's saving jobs for youth and that tipped workers really don't want a raise. Missouri Jobs with Justice is asking people to print out cards to give to their servers in restaurants and other tipped employees. The cards ask them to join the campaign and contact their legislators. You can find the cards and get involved at www.missouri.gov www.saveourrays.org.
There's a new mobile app which helps students plan for college. It will track your ACT scores, upload documents for admissions advisors to see, find scholarships, write essays, and chat directly with the colleges all from one place. No, it doesn't bribe them to admit you. Actually, this app is aimed at working-class kids and is being sponsored by the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO to help youth find scholarships. It has ACT and SAT practice tests, deadline reminders, financial aid training, and mainly gives info on thousands of scholarships and aims at fitting the students to the available ones. The app is called College Coaching Network. For more information, call Claude Harris at 913-777-4940. You don't have to be from a union family to use it.
The new musical based on the life of garment factory owner Nell Donnelly opens this week at the MTH Theater and got a big write-up in the Kansas City Star. They said the legacy of Nell Donnelly Reed infiltrated four of the basic food groups of life in 20th century Kansas City: business, politics, crime, and scandal. Well, they left one out, Union Buster. That part of the legacy wasn't mentioned in the article about the play, and we'll lay odds it isn't in the script either, as it was written by Donnelly's great-great-nephew, Terrence O'Malley, just in time to celebrate the Irish on St. Pat's Day. Donnelly founded the famous Nellie Don House Dress Company, which by 1937 had 1,300 workers and was the largest dress establishment under one roof in the world. It was in the mid-1930s that the International Ladies Garment Workers Union successfully organized Kansas City's women's coat and suit factories. They then appropriated $100,000 to organize Nellie Don. But Nell was active in the Democratic Party and married to former Senator James A. Reed. Reed was not only a kingpin in the Pendergast machine, but a union buster in his own right. As a lawyer, he represented Ford Motor Company during the 1937 sit-down strike in Kansas City. That's a four-year strike when Henry Ford fired all the union members and replaced them with scabs. His thugs also blew up the union hall. With Reed's help, Donnelly became a master at fighting the garment union. She organized a company union and managed to avoid a 1940 NLRB decision, ordering it disbanded until 1948. She was also a notorious anti-Semite and indoctrinated anti-Semitism in her workers to sow distrust of the union's leadership, which was Jewish. We note that the play, which opens tonight, is an Actors Equity production, so we urge the union members in the cast not to let the public go home with a totally sanitized version of the lives of two of Kansas City's most notorious union busters.
House Bill 1413, the super anti-union public sector bill passed in Missouri last year, took a beating this week from the courts on both sides of the state. On March 8th, the Circuit Court in St. Louis issued an order enjoining the Missouri Department of Labor and the Missouri State Board of Mediation from administering and enforcing the law. And yesterday, Judge James Canizar in Jackson County also enjoined the law in a separate case. Presumably, the state of Missouri will appeal. They have 90 days, but unions need some guidance, says Attorney John Boyd, on what will happen if these judges are reversed and the law goes back into effect. There are deadlines for recertification, for filing the draconian paperwork required for union finances, and fines of $100 a day in jail time could go into effect whenever a judge rules with no grace period. Attorney Boyd is counseling any union with public sector employee contracts to be prepared because the Missouri Board of Mediation is refusing to give any advice, although they are the ones who would assess the fines if the law is reimposed. Great system, huh? The news tonight was read by the all-male team of Jeff Milliken, Chuck Wise Miller, Tom Gebon, and Michael Savoie.
Thank you, Los Angeles School Teachers. This is for you. I'm just a small voice, now in motion, sending big love like a potion Watch how a single kid can make a mind open. Yes, I may only have one voice, but I can make an explosion. And everything that's done for me by my teachers daily, I will scream them out today. Will you listen to what I say? This is our strike song, our education. Prove them we're right, song. Our power's turned on, starting right now we'll be strong. We'll sing this strike song, and it is so critical that everybody else believes, 'cause I know this is exactly what I need. Losing lessons, they make them walk. Everybody's worried about me. In too deep, said they're in too deep, in too deep. It's been months with no contract, and what they're losing, they won't get back. They still believe, yeah, they still believe. And everything that's done for me by my teachers daily, I will scream them loud today. Will you listen to what I say? This is our strike song, our education. Prove them we're right, song. Our power's turned on, starting right now we'll be strong. We'll sing this strike song, and it is so critical that everybody else believes, 'cause I know this is exactly what I need. I'm just a small voice, now in motion, sending big love like a potion. Watch how a single kid can make a mind open. Yes, I may only have one voice, but I can make an explosion. This is our strike song, our education.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight we have shared hosts. Myself is Chris Mann. We have Joyce McCauley and
Christina Desmond.
And we are happy to have longtime labor activist on the phone and now writer for Labor Notes, Barbara Mandaloni. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for being on the show. The song we've just heard was the fifth grader Stacy Sheffy. She sang a tribute to her teachers as they went on strike in Los Angeles, and that was called Strike Song. If you live in Oklahoma, Minnesota, California, West Virginia, Kentucky, and many other states, chances are you'd turn on your TV and your child's teacher may be on the 6 o'clock news. Tonight we will explore the current wave of teacher strikes. Why are they happening? What will be the influence on the labor movement as a whole? And are these strikes and walkouts important for the health of our democracy?
And tonight we have Barbara Mandaloni, who is an educator, education coordinator at Labor Notes. She recently served as president of Massachusetts Teachers Association and is a longtime writer and educator. My name is Christina Dismang. I've been teaching for 4 years in the Kansas City Public Schools, and I'm a local member of AFT 691.
And I'm Chris Mann. I'm a special education teacher, and I've taught in both St. Louis and Kansas City. And through the eyes of my students, I have an appreciation for the uniqueness of every person, and I believe in public education as a means of socialization, cooperation, and making the world better.
And I'm Joyce McCauley. I'm a 30-year veteran of the Kansas City Public Schools and have recently retired and am subbing. Apparently, I can't stay out of the classroom. So we, again, welcome, Barbara. We're so glad you're here. And we kind of want to get started with talking about the educators' right to strike. Do we have right to strike as educators? Does it matter? Is it making an effect on salaries and classroom conditions? Barbara, would you respond to that?
Barbara Mataloni, I think the short answer is strikes work. We've seen that in all the places where educators have gone out, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Kentucky, Arizona, UTLA, Oakland, the charter school strikes in Chicago and L.A. In some of those places, strikes are legal, and in some of those places, strikes are not legal. But when everybody walks out, the legality has not proved to be an issue. Teachers have not lost their jobs who've gone out on strike. So, you know, while it's something for union leaders to fret about, the bottom line is when we collectively act together and withhold our labor, it's going to be effective, and it's looking to be absolutely necessary in order to preserve public education.
And one thing that I think a big question on everyone's mind is, within the past year, we've seen all these different states striking. What would be your best understanding of why teachers are striking now?
Well, I mean, I think that's like a really complicated answer. And one of the things I was saying to Chris when we were preparing for this is I'd be really interested in hearing, after I'm done, from like those of you who are in the classroom, about the conditions in the classroom, because in many ways I think that will help people understand best what's going on. So, you know, on the one hand, we have just a culmination of years and years, decades of austerity budgets, of underfunding of our public schools, which not only results in low wages for educators and a tax on their pensions, but also really profoundly impacts the experiences that young people are having in the classroom every day. And educators have known for years that between the high-stakes testing and the underfunding, that they're not able to do the work that they want to do, the live to the values that brought them into the classroom. So the pressure has just increased and turned up more and more. And I also think, you know, we've been learning from each other that in the midst of these crises that are being created because of the really what are efforts to undermine public education and privatize public education, as we've been struggling under this burden, we've also been talking to each other, learning from each other. The Chicago teacher strike in 2012 wasn't just a great moment for Chicago, but was a really important moment for educators across the country. And 7 years later, 6 years later, we're seeing a manifestation of what we learned from them and what we've been teaching each other since then in both formal and informal ways.
What do you think has been probably the top main issues that has been brought up during these recent teacher protests?
I would like to.
Go ahead.
I would like to. When I was watching the events around Los Angeles teachers, I was impressed that they even mentioned, but almost in a big way, special education students and teachers, who quite a bit of our work is outside the classroom day of doing the necessary legal paperwork for the students and their disabilities. And that is a necessary part, but quite a bit of that rests for outside the classroom hours. And then, of course, the safety and equipment needed for students with disabilities is quite a lot. And often the funding is not there.
Well, that's true, and I think that we can also attach that to the regular classroom setting as well in terms of funding. Sometimes it's simple stuff. If you want I'm really not kidding. Sometimes you can't get a stapler and staples and basic paper and pencils and things like that for students without sometimes buying them for yourself. And of course, the time involved in planning to make sure that all the students' needs are being met academically and they're so diverse. So we're not just planning for one level of academic achievement, we're planning for several. And again, that goes outside the actual contract day.
Yeah, and as you're all suggesting, I mean, you're doing this work. There's been a tremendous overload of paperwork, and sort of the amount of time that you spend accounting for your work rather than being able to do the work of being a teacher is just mind-boggling. And that means extending hours and working. You know, teachers have always worked way beyond, you know, their contracted work day. But doing that under the pressure of not having the resources that you need for students, lots of these strikes have included that there need to be nurses in the schools, librarians. So many schools don't have school libraries, don't have certified librarians anymore, counselors for our students. There aren't enough books. Class sizes are too large. So there's been more work with fewer resources, and all of that within a context of being told that you're doing a bad job, that you're not meeting the accountability standards of high-stakes testing. And, of course, it's designed to reduce resources, put pressure on with the high-stakes standardized testing, and then prove, as it were, that schools or public schools are failing, so that there is an opening for charters and vouchers. Teachers have been suffering under that for two decades at least. It's getting worse every year. And they've had enough, and they're talking to each other and learning from each other about how to organize.
And I agree with you there, Barbara, about librarians and counselors. I really didn't realize what a good librarian does to a school. They have contact with the free public libraries in our community, and they are able to get books and resources for us to teach lessons. And I didn't realize that until we had a great librarian at our school, and it's so much appreciated. It actually helps the school run smoother.
And another thing that I think has affected the morale and self-esteem of a lot of teachers is the idea that someone with a degree in any area can be taught in 6 or 7 weeks in a summer how to run a classroom. And so a lot of these teachers, and some of them have turned out to be pretty good as they go back to school and get some traditional training, but I just think it's inappropriate to assume that anybody can teach if you just, you know, hand them a manual and give them a little bit of training. You know, it's a lot more, the job's a lot more complicated than that.
Absolutely. And the way that teaching has been devalued, both in terms of compensation and the loss of professional autonomy. So, yeah, we can teach somebody how to walk into a classroom in 6 weeks to do this work, and we're not going to give you an opportunity as an educator of experience to actually use your knowledge and experience in order to design your own curriculum and develop your own assessments and make your own decisions within the context of the community of educators about how students are doing. We're going to take all that away from you, and then we're going to pay you less money, and we're going to say, yeah, just about anybody can do this job.
Yeah, one thing that I find... Sorry, what were you going to say?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that, well, I'm relatively still new to teaching. I've been teaching for about 4 years. And one thing, as we're having this conversation, that I'm always constantly brought back to is whenever I told people I want to become a teacher, one thing they always said, and I always used to take as a joke, they would say, well, you definitely don't do it for the pay. You do it for teaching is a work of heart, not necessarily for the pay, and always would nod and agree with that. Until when I actually got to be in the classroom and realize how much, how
little pay you have.
Exactly. How much of my own resources I use, and how much I became really, really well adept on finding my own free resources. But there's a time where I don't have enough energy to do that. So I understand where teachers take shortcuts. I understand when teachers don't necessarily fall through with things because sometimes the resources are not there at all.
Yeah. And another thing that I noticed is the last few years before I retired was those of us with more experience seem to be listened to even less than the newer teachers. And in terms of the high-stakes testing, I know that over the years the testing has changed a little bit, but there's certain elements of the test and certain things kids must know if they're going to be successful at that. And it was difficult to kind of be listened to that last few years, you know, as an educator. And which kind of odd to me, I've been on a lot of leadership teams and I've been on conferences and a lot of PDs, and the district has paid a lot of money educating me and the teachers within my generation. And I would think that they would want to continue to get something from their investment. So that's kind of a thing I've been thinking about lately, is that idea of all these years of training and stuff, and most of it's been from the one district, but you know, as we get a little bit older, then I guess they figure we don't know as much for some reason.
Well, you have too much confidence in your knowledge and experience, and that's going to be threatening to the boss, and you cost too much money. So, you know, nationally, we've seen veteran teachers teacher evaluations being used to push veteran teachers out, you know, basic terms because you cost more money, and in other terms because you have confidence in yourself and your work, and you might stand up to the boss. But I want to go back to the question about, like, how have these movements started? And you know, in different places, they've started in different ways. So if you look at places like United Teachers of Los Angeles with the strike, incredibly successful strike that they just had a month and a half ago, that was 4 years of developing structures. They elected new leadership that was elected on a platform that said they were going to build a more democratic rank-and-file union and a more militant union. And they've been preparing to strike for years. And they've been doing that by going into buildings and getting members talking about the issues that matter to them, developing the demands for the contract campaign, building relationships with the community, including the community in the contract demand development, so that they included things like an end to random wanding of students in school, which was primarily targeting Black and Brown students. So you have one example of a strike that was really like built from the bottom up with the support and guidance of the leadership that said, this is what we're going to do. We need to build our power. We need to have the community be a part of this. And we need to do it very clearly to save the public schools in Los Angeles, where charterization was profound. And then you have other strikes, like in West Virginia, where the organizing was entirely outside of the elected leadership of the statewide association. And it was the members having conversations not dissimilar from the conversation that we were just having, going like, well, yeah, this is bad, and this is bad, and this is bad. But moving those conversations from just a litany of how difficult it is to be a teacher these days to, well, what do we want to do about it?
Yes.
How can we organize ourselves to do something about it?
Yes, into organizing it into some action. And Barbara, that's going to lead into our next segment about reviewing all of these strikes. But we do have to take a station break, and we will be back after a minute and a half.
Evening at the Talk House. A terrifying detour into a bleak future where American exceptionalism, fascism, and desperation fuse to form an Orwellian dystopia, corrupting America's most sacred endeavor, show business. Written by and starring Wallace Shawn, along with Matthew Broderick, Jill Eikenberry, and more, on the Thursday night special at 7 p.m.
Most times, KKFI moves against the stream, but just saying play KKFI to your smart speaker will bring our stream to you.
John Pugliano, author of The Robots Are Coming, speaks about the jobs of the future on Exploration, Monday morning from 5 to 6.
KKFI is the Kansas City area's independent, non-commercial community radio station. We seek to stimulate, educate, and entertain our audience to reflect the diversity of the local and world community, and to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. Interested in volunteering? Contact 816-994-7864 or go online at kkfi.org and click the volunteer tab. Thank you for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Oklahoma teachers work a long day, shaping young minds for very little pay. We don't know where the money went, 'cause the textbooks we have still say Bush is president. Oklahoma placed 49th out of 50 states for teacher salary, and maybe we're not dead last. But if not for Mississippi, then that's where we'd be. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature. You better fund, our public schools. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature. When we stand up for ourselves, we stand up for our students. Educators work around the clock. Now is the time to demand some more funds. But if we left it up to Trump, he'd pay you the same, but he'd arm you with guns. And already we've made great strides. They've offered a bill to give us $6,000, but we've been waiting on a raise for years. And we'll push for $10,000 till we have it our way. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature. You better fund, our public schools. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature. When we stand up for ourselves, we stand up for our students. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature. You better fund, our public schools. Mary Fallon, governor, and the legislature. When we stand up for ourselves, we stand up for our students.
Welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight our topic is Teaching the Labor Movement How to Strike. This is KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, 90.1 FM. Barbara Mandaloni is our guest on the phone. She's a writer and union activist from Labor Notes, and she has led us into our second part here, where what we're going to do now is review the characteristics of recent strikes, beginning with Los Angeles and Oakland, followed by West Virginia, Kentucky, Denver, and Minnesota. So I read in Vox magazine by Alexia Fernandez. She wrote that this is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that there was a record number of U.S. workers who went on strike or stopped working in 2018. A total of 485,000 employees were involved in a major work stoppage last year. It's the highest number since 1986, and public school teachers were behind the year's largest walkouts. So the first strike I wanted to point to was Los Angeles, which I think the whole country was in awe of. It was led by UTLA, United Teachers Los Angeles. And from what I could read, the working conditions and the activism of the union organized that strike successfully. And like Barbara pointed out, they did this over time. They worked within the schools and had active union committees working in each school, first to describe the problems they had, and then to go about and actively work for that. And so that how impressive was that with 50,000 teachers, parents, and students out at rallies each morning of the strike? And so I think we can just sort of use that as a model and realize that they did get help from Chicago teachers who did similar things in 2012. But the extension of this, I think, is that the union, and Barbara, you might want to add to this, the UTLA added a bigger arena to the strike by entering into the discussion about charter schools. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the union made this a fight that was a fight about the learning conditions for students. It was a fight about teacher salaries and health care. It was a fight as well, though, and you know, broadly and specifically to defend public education in Los Angeles. I can at the moment I can tell a story where I was out in L.A. I was coming back after having been out for the strike, came back east, and went back to L.A. I'm renting a car. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. It's just me and two guys at the rental counter. And they asked me why I'm wearing a UTLA shirt when I'm from Massachusetts. I said, I've been out to support the strike. I'm coming back out. This is a strike that's really important to everybody in the country. Why? How could that be? And one guy says, it's an important strike because there are people who are trying to privatize our public schools. And the teachers are fighting to protect public education. They're trying to privatize the charter schools. There's a guy at the rental counter. Mm-hmm. And his partner says, well, if they privatize public schools, that'll be the end of democracy. So
wow.
UTLA educated the community so profoundly and so deeply that those two guys at the rental counter understood what the strike was about and why it was important.
And why it was so thorough.
That's what they did. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Oakland, conditions were similar, although the Bay Area, where a lot of the teachers lived, there were severe austerity there, so to the point where the teachers could not even live in the communities where they taught. And so it was like more severe. Los Angeles sent union help there. Students were very active. There was parental support. However, many people are, it's coming out in the press that perhaps the union agreed too quickly on the union leadership. So those are the strikes I wanted to review. Although Oakland also had similar broader challenges about the charterization and a bigger, they also had the bigger picture scope. So that was good about that. Okay, and next I think we're going to just review a little bit about West Virginia.
Well, you know, the West Virginia story is so interesting because they did the strike in 2018 and they were able to I believe they were first offered 2% and they said, absolutely not, that's not going to cut it. And so they hung in there and hung in there and were able to get a 5% raise. They still, I don't believe, Barbara, you may know a little more about this, but it doesn't look like they've gotten too much relief on health care. But this strike was so, 20,000 teachers, 55 counties in West Virginia, and it lasted from February 22nd to March 7th in 2018. So it was interesting when the West Virginia State House tried to pass a bill that would allow more money for parents to use for charter schools. And there was another thing on that bill. The teachers went out for something like half a day and they said, oh, I guess we don't need that bill after all. So the strike before in 2018 basically taught them a lesson that the teachers, you know, when they ask for something and they feel they need it, they need it. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah, I mean, I think the West Virginia story is just so interesting in terms of both strikes. First, like for the strike of 2018, they went out. This was organized by the rank and file. And the leadership eventually caught up and authorized the strike, you know, took a vote and authorized it because they knew they had to, because the rank and file was going to go whether or not the leadership wanted it to happen. When they went out, they went out for public sector workers in West Virginia, and they were demanding 5% for everybody, and they had the community support. And one of the first things they did when they knew they were going to go on strike was to make sure that the children in those schools were going to be fed while they were out on strike, because most of those students, the great, great majority, require not only school lunches, but often school breakfast and a meal at the end of the day. So they struck for their students, and they, while they were striking for their salaries, and they were striking for public sector workers. When the leadership came back and said, after 5 days, we have a deal. We're going to give you 5%, and we're going to give other workers 2%. They said, we refuse that deal. And that became a wildcat strike. The leadership wanted them to settle, and they went out on a wildcat strike. So their power there as rank and file union members was profound. And you're right, they've still not gotten reasonable settlement around their health insurance issues. But then they were able, as you know, to do it again this year. The state legislature came back with bills that were designed as retaliation bills. They were going to bring charters to West Virginia for the first time. West Virginia does not have charter schools. And that same group of educators who've been organizing themselves more deeply and building their networks educated other teachers, paraprofessionals, and the community about the dangers of charter schools. They walked out in the morning. By the afternoon, that bill was dead. It was an amazing victory.
Yeah, it was really, really was powerful. And, I think, again, like we've been talking earlier, that when one district does the work and goes out and says, no, this is not going to happen. We need more, and we need more for our kids, and we need more for us, that it can actually work and be really powerful. Denver also made an impact on with some salary issues and some other things. They were out for just about 3 days, and yet they were still able to come up with some raises and also the ability to use professional development units. Free in-district courses were offered to advance teacher education, move up lanes in the salary schedule as they got more hours and more certification elements. They got a full cost of living increase in the second and third years of the agreement, so that's good. They have a really interesting structure of pay, though. They've also got $2,000 incentive for hard-to-staff positions and teachers working at Title I schools, and then another incentive of $3,000 for educators in 30 highest priority schools. So, and when I looked at their whole structure, there's a lot of other things that they can get paid for, including teacher leadership and stipends for different kind of community or committee work and that kind of thing. But the main bit of money they got through the strike.
And two more strikes I think we really should be touching base on. Almost the year anniversary coming on up for Oklahoma and Kentucky. And what's interesting about Oklahoma, when I very first started teaching, is there were recruiters from Oklahoma recruiting Missouri teachers to teach in Oklahoma. I thought that was rather odd, and I kind of brushed it aside. But after hearing the stories from teachers in Oklahoma and what they were going through, it didn't surprise me. One thing I pointed out is one of the consistencies that we see throughout all of these strikes was wanting better funding. For over 10 years, there hadn't been a raise for Oklahoma city public school teachers. There's overcrowded classrooms. And after putting enough pressure on their union for proper education funding, last April 2nd, they were able to go out on strike on a 10-day strike for better raises and better funding for their classrooms. So that was a 10-day strike. I felt like it had a big impact since it was Oklahoma City's not too far away. I mean, relatively speaking, from Kansas City, and I know it kind of that splash made down there was definitely heard locally. And another one starting at almost the exact same time was Kentucky. Now that one was a little bit different, that in the sense that it was tied to their pension. It was against Senate Bill 525 that was going to be changing in negative reasons teachers' pensions in Kentucky, since they don't pull from Social Security, they're waiting for their pensions, and having negative impacts on public school teachers, those who save up their whole life and for their retirement, that when they go to retire, it's not there. But unlike Oklahoma, back in April, it didn't necessarily stop it for a short while. But Barbara, did you hear recently about the walkout on March 12th?
Yeah, Kentucky, again, and this was entirely rank and file organized. I've actually been waiting to be in touch with some of the people in Kentucky who did this. But the Jefferson County, I guess it's township district, had a call for a sick out. And this is not sanctioned by the state. Again, I think state leadership maybe came in at the end to sanction it when they knew that it was going to happen, whether or not they sanctioned it. And they were able to shut down some bills that were looking to bring and extend voucher programs in Kentucky. So, once again, moral of the story, strikes work.
Yeah, and our wonderful engineer, Jen, is giving us a three-minute warning here. So we're almost out of time. In our final moments of our discussion, what we could do is each of us sort of summarize in a minute or less what we all want to take away from this discussion. As Barbara says, strikes work is one. But I want to quote here one singular aspect of the walkouts and even the strikes is that they were organized from below, outside of attempted control by state union officials. And although teachers and other school workers were local union activists, were often leaders, they were part of the movement, not its masters. So the many activists, it's called Education Spring, concurred that the unions, had they been doing what they should have, some of these Facebook movements would not have been needed, these spontaneous. But the point is that they happen. And Barbara, you want to conclude?
Well, you just said a lot that I think is really important is that, you know, this is a movement building. Other things that I think are important to pull out, these are places where workers and the community and students organized together. And they organized around a shared commitment to the public good, in this case, public education. They came to understand that the public good is under attack by forces that are looking to privatize it and bust our unions. And they developed political consciousness, if you just go back to the rental store, in the course of this. So these strikes have not only won demands for educators, but they're winning demands for their students, and they're educating all of us about the importance of preserving and protecting public education and the public good, and that there are people out there that are trying to take it away. So we got to, buckle in and keep fighting.
Okay, well, that says it all. Thank you, Barbara, for being with us. Thank you, Christina and Joyce, and thank you for listening.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, journeyman wireman of IBW 124. This Saturday in North Kansas City, many union members will be marching in and attending the Snake Saturday Parade, which is the kickoff of St. Patrick's Day event in our area. Let me tell you about Irish and American labor leader James Connolly. Born on June 5, 1868, in Edinburgh, Scotland, to Irish immigrant parents, James Connolly joined the British military at age 14 to escape his extreme poverty. 7 years later, at the age of 21, Connolly left military life and eventually settled in Dublin in 1896. In 1903, Connolly immigrated to the United States, living for a brief period in Troy, New York, with a relative, and worked for an insurance firm as a salesman. By 1905, he left Troy to pursue his ideals of organizing a militant working-class movement and soon joined the newly formed IWW as a member and full-time organizer. Connolly worked primarily in the New York City, Newark, New Jersey area and was a family friend of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. A prolific writer of historical, cultural, political, economic, and social analysis, as well as a one-man editor and publisher of his own books and newspaper, many people of opposing political beliefs within the labor movement and the left valued and praised Connolly's insightful views. His most famous book, Labor in Irish History, did not limit itself to Ireland and included analysis of the horrible conditions of the British working class and the need for worldwide working class revolution. Connolly considered himself a socialist, but always advocated revolutionary syndicalism, which he called industrial unionism, and advocated for a political system known as a cooperative commonwealth. Connolly did not consider himself an anarcho-syndicalist, however, in 1908, when a split in the IWW occurred between the Marxist Daniel De Leon and the anarcho-syndicalists, Connolly sided with the anarcho-syndicalists. Although De Leon was a major influence on Connolly for many years, he nevertheless became repulsed over time by De Leon's sectarianism and dogmatism. De Leon argued for a revolution that involved seizing control of the state by politicians through the election of a socialist party, and that the role of industrial unions would be to support that party. Connolly advocated instead for a revolution that gives immediate power to new forms of social organization, a revolution led by the workers themselves, without being subordinate to any party. Connolly advocated for a cooperative commonwealth as a new system of governance, which is a society in which all productive property is owned in common and managed by democratic cooperatives, industry by industry, region by region. He wanted all of society to be run and organized democratically for the benefit of all of its members. As he said of his own people, the Irish people will only be free when they own everything from the plow to the stars. Connolly returned to Ireland in 1910 and became an organizer for the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, ITGWU. In 1913, along with Jim Larkin, who would later support Ben Fletcher's IWW Maritime and Dock Workers Union in Philadelphia, the president of the ITGWU, Connolly organized a general strike in Dublin that paralyzed commerce and transport for many weeks. During the general strike, Connolly organized the Irish Citizen Army among striking workers in a self-defense response to widespread beatings of striking workers by the Irish police and British military. The Irish Citizen Army became the nucleus of the Dublin Division of the Army of the Republic during the 1916 Easter Rebellion against British rule of Ireland. Connolly was badly wounded and imprisoned after the failed Easter Rebellion, and despite his severe wounds, was tied to a chair and executed by the British military on May 12, 1916. Though considered by many historians to be an Irish nationalist, Connolly did not believe in ignoring class divisions in the name of nationalism. He firmly believed that Ireland could not be free until the working class of Ireland was free. Connolly did not live to see the failure of the Irish Revolution to be a working class revolution, nor the bankruptcy of so-called modern-day democratic socialism, nor the revolution in Russia, which happened just a year after his death. However, Connolly's legacy and his writings, in particular their pragmatism of the need of industrial unionism and the avoidance of sectarianism, are as relevant today as they were when he wrote them. Connolly died for his beliefs, not beliefs based on theory, but based instead on a lifetime of witnessing thousands of men and women exploited to the edge of despair and starvation by the greed of a few. We should remember James Connolly with this final quote: "A revolution will only be achieved when the working, ordinary people of the world, us, the working class, get up off our knees and take back what is rightfully ours." That was adapted from a piece on James Connolly on the IWW website. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Have a great evening, everyone.
And that was Arianna Eckel with Remember Our Struggle. I'm Judy Ansel, and I got the calendar. On Friday, that's tomorrow, it's Global Youth Climate Strike Rally in Solidarity at UMKC. This is going to be at the University Playhouse at 800 East 51st Street. That's a paved space in a lawn just outside the UMKC Library. And there's metered parking a short block length to the north and also to the south. Support the Global Youth Climate Strike. Wyandotte County, Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast, Saturday, March 16th, 8:15 for breakfast, 9 o'clock for speakers, at Las Islas Marias, 7516 State Avenue. Speakers are David Haley, Senator, and Bill Reardon. Surge KC, March Mass Meeting, Impact versus Intent. This is Standing Up for Racial Justice, Monday, March 18th, 6:30 to 8:30 at St. Mark's Hope and Peace Lutheran Church, 3800 Troost. Monthly clinic for victims of wage theft, also Monday, March 18th, 5 to 8 p.m. This is at El Centro at 650 Minnesota Avenue in KCK. And if you've been stiffed on your wages, you can get free legal assistance there. Rally for $15 and a union with Boots Riley, March 30th, 4:30 p.m., Grove Park, East Truman Road, and Benton Boulevard, sponsored by Stand Up KC. And then a screening of Boots Riley's Sorry to Bother You, March 30th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Gem Theater, also sponsored by Stand Up KC. And you can find out how to get tickets on Stand Up KC's Facebook page. Bureau of Labor Statistics Data Users Conference on Prices and Employment, How to Use Their Statistics, Particularly for Bargaining, Monday, April 1st, 9 a.m. to 12:30. It's at the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, 1 Memorial Drive, KCMO. RSVP to BLS Info Kansas City at bls.gov. Organizer Training 101, sponsored by the Greater Kansas City IWW, on April 6th and 7th. Register by sending an email to kciww@gmail.com. Our calendar and our upcoming shows, as well as our archive shows, are on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That way you never miss the Heartland Labor Forum. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is called A Teach-In at the Border. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.